hello there, Brendan. It's good to see you again. It's been a long time.
A long time?
That's my line. I appreciate my lines. Let me do it one more time. From one, I haven't seen you in such a long time, Brendan. A long time.
Jeez, did you know? Is he directing the show now?
I guess he's decided to. Mr. Guinness, I guess you can just proceed. Thank you, Jason. You're such a kind young man. I came by today specifically, you see, to talk to you about last week's movie, Lavender Hill Mobs. I wanted to give you a bit of exclusive trivia, if you would have it.
Okay, shoot.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. Yes, are you familiar with a science fiction picture I did in 1977? It was called Star Wars.
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
Yes. Quite an interesting little picture. Not my cup of tea, you see, but we all have bills to pay, don't we?
Of course.
Yes, of course we do. Now, a bit of trivia. When George Lucas approached me for that role, I said, George, go fuck yourself in the deepest ditch. But he was persistent, you see. And during our conversations, when he'd forced his way into my home and taken my wife hostage, he said to me, I want you to play a sort of space wizard. And I said, I like that idea, but I have an idea of my own. And he said, what's that? And I said, what if you purchase the remake rights to Lavender Hill Mob, you see? And then we have Obi-Wan Kenobi, space wizard. He's a goody two-shoes, you see. And he spends almost 20 years working for the Empire, helping them build their Death Star, you see. And then, 20 years in, he decides that he's going to stage a big score. Hmm? He's going to steal as much, I don't know, what do they hold of value in the Star Wars universe, I said.
Midichlorians?
That's what George said, and I said, no, George, that's in the blood. You can't keep that in a vial. It was strange. It was strange, you see, that I knew more about his property than him. But that's why he wanted me to be in the movie.
Right.
So I said, he steals something. Oh, say a raft of TIE fighters. You see, he steals a raft of TIE fighters, and then he takes them to Batuu, which is a planet in the Outer Rim, and he tries to sell them on Batuu, but they are purchased by some Tatooineese schoolgirls. You see, and it turns out that these TIE fighters are actually made of a sort of Star Wars space metal. I don't know what you would call it, but Dunium. I think it's called Dunium. Yes, it's made of Dunium, and it's what the Death Star was made out of. And it was very valuable. We were trying to trade that Dunium, but instead the Tatooineese schoolgirls get it, you see, and they take it to Tatooine, and there that Dunium is discovered by one Luke Skywalker, and that is where our story would start. And George said, Alec, are you fucked in the head? And I said, you're the one that's fucked in the head. And he said, would you do it for £1,000? And I said, yes.
Wow, that's amazing trivia, Mr. Guinness.
I've never heard that story before, Mr. Guinness. That's an incredible story. Yes, well, it was a different time, you see. It was a very different time. Anyways, I'm so glad you watched that movie last week. It was absolutely splendid. I think you two are the only people to watch that movie in the last 5 to 10 years. You're the only possible people who have seen it. So thank you from the bottom of my heart and sending a check to my grandchildren.
Well, it was our pleasure.
Our pleasure, Mr. Guinness.
You're always welcome.
Alrighty then. Yes,
Much nicer. You're much nicer than when Michael Caine comes here.
Oh, Michael Caine. Yes, he's a bit of a prat, isn't he? Yes. Yeah. Be careful of him. Watch out for him. But I must go. Jetpack.
And there he goes.
On his heavenly jetpack.
On his heavenly jetpack. Oh, Jason, this is, some scholars maintain this is what you would call a podcast.
It does fit the technical definitions of what a podcast is, as established by the Oxford English Dictionary in the year of our Lord, 1999. Before podcasts even existed, they'd already invented the word.
I was going to say,
I would go so far as to say it was Steve Jobs that stole the word pod from podcast to make iPod, and then he could claim that he invented podcasts, but he didn't.
And now he's dead, so who's to tell?
Mm. We won.
So yes, this is a podcast. My name is Brendan.
My name is Jason.
And this podcast is called For Screen
and Country.
And on this show, Jason, every week without fail, except that sometimes there's fail, we talk about movies on the British Film Institute Top 100 British Films of All Time list, as curated in the year 1999. We have done a lot of these movies so far. I think we're almost up to 70 films at this point. So we are making some headway. But this week, we are talking about our second of two Merchant Ivory films on this list. We're talking about number 73, A Room with a View. We got some comments to read about the Lavender Hill Mob, which is the movie that we covered last week.
Bum, bum, ba-da-dum, ba-dum. Bum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum.
Thanks for the joke, the reference to something that no one will know what you're talking about because we talked about it off air.
That's great. It's just for you, Brendan. Sometimes it's just for you. And for those that recognize it.
For those that recognize, we salute you. And for those who are about to rock.
No, them, I just give a polite wave.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're about to rock. A good day, sir.
Exactly. Me ladies, continue rocking.
and a joyous Zeppelin to you.
Oh, I wish I had a Zeppelin. God, that'd be great. Can we get a Zeppelin? Maybe we should get a Patreon going and try to get a Zeppelin.
I think that should be our only, like, you know how on Patreon where they say, like, if we raise this much money, we can finally do this and get advertising. Mm. If we raise this much money, we can finally put out bonus episodes. Our thing should just say, if we raise $10 million, we're just going to buy a Zeppelin.
We'll buy a Zeppelin, and then we'll do the equivalent of what Joe Rogan just did. He moved to Texas and set up, like, a podcasting studio and shit. We will set up a podcasting studio on that Zeppelin.
Well,
and me and you, we'll go and we'll kidnap Nathan to hell with his kids. We'll leave them there, and then we'll set up the podcasting empire from a Zeppelin looking down on all the awful people that will subscribe and pay us money.
But comments, Jason, take us through our first comment about the Lavender Hill Mob from one of our faithful listeners.
Yes, our faithful listener, Victoria Stewart, writes in. Victoria says, super fun. This is about the Lavender Hill Mob, right? Mm-hmm. Super fun. I had a friend who thought someone should do a remake at the Empire State Building.
There you go. Empire State Building.
Does your friend have sway in either Hollywood or, I don't know, what would you call the British film industry like? Not London.
Brittywood?
Brittywood, yeah.
and side note, unrelated question, does your friend own a Zeppelin? Because this is going to be a big part of this.
If she has a Zeppelin, or he, you don't say, then we can make this work.
We can make it work. We'll put something together.
We do the podcast, we raise the money, we do the remake of the movie at the Empire State Building.
That's the name of the movie.
That's it. That's the entire title. Well, we want people to be sure of what they're seeing. We don't want any vagaries. That's the thing. You sell something vaguely, people don't know what to expect. If you tell them exactly what they're getting, they will come.
I remember your pitch was to do Citizen Kane and just replace the title with the entire script.
You remember, for instance, my favorite Tom Hanks movie of the early 2000s, that dude that crashes in the plane and gets home at the end. That's my favorite Tom Hanks movie.
Yeah, Castaway doesn't really drive home what that movie's about.
No, that's why they called it that in European territories instead of what they called it here, which is what I just said 6 seconds ago.
You'd think the American title would be less subtle in that regard, but... All right, well, Matthew P. Eels says, I have the good fortune of seeing this for the first time on the big screen many, many years ago.
Ooh.
It is absolutely delightful, and I'm tickled to know that the director ended up directing A Fish Called Wanda towards the end of his career, which, spoiler alert, still to come, and spoiler alert, I'm just going to say right now, I love that fucking movie.
Oh, me too. So, I love that movie. I'm not going to get deep into it, but that's a great movie.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to see it again, actually, to see if it holds up in the, like, 15 years since I watched it last.
Mm-hmm.
All right, our next comment comes from the wonderfully named John Mendenhall. I like that, Mendenhall. You guys want to go get beers at Mendenhall? I don't mean to make fun of your name, John. I just think it's cool. For years, I knew it only for its pre-fame appearance of a certain icon, but was delighted to see that it really is a great movie in and of itself. Does he mean Alec Guinness?
No, he's talking about Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, well, I mean, Alec Guinness was an icon, too. Yeah.
Yeah, but Alec Guinness, this was not like pre-fame Alec Guinness, though. Like, I think people already kind of knew who he was.
That's true. I mean, yeah, he was in Great Expectations. And that was what, like 48 or something?
Yeah, it was a few years before this, for sure.
Yeah. And The Man in the White Suit, which we still haven't watched.
We still haven't watched. I think that's the same year or maybe the year before.
All right. What's our next comment, Brendan?
Susie Thomas says, for reasons unknown, I always fall asleep in the middle of this movie and wake up right at the end. I think it has something to do with the voice Alec Guinness uses. So apparently, very soothing, nice, sleepy voice from Alec.
Perhaps you should try the Lady Killers if you wish to go to sleep.
Oh, wow. You come here for the harsh takes on the Lady Killers, the original guys.
Absolutely roasted.
Boom, roasted. Roasted, toasted, and tattooed, as they say.
Our next comment, Brendan, comes from Adam Hures.
The fuck is Adam, a comment, Brendan?
A comment, Brendan. Well, it's for you specifically, so this is whatever I say, this is meant to be about you personally, so take it as such.
Okay.
Adam Hures says, this movie is quite a bit of fun. You're a bit of fun. That's good. You are a bit of fun. That's what I've been told anyways. Mariah, hi. Fast-paced and short makes for a great watch. Oh, that's no. Like you. You've long been fast-paced and short. Temper-wise sometimes, but certainly height sometimes, you know, when you shrink up, you're short money. You're short lots of things. You're never short hair. That's one thing you're never short.
Yeah, I'm a very short man, for sure.
That's right. Let's see. Fast patient short makes for a great watch. Also, as I make my way through these Ealing Studio films, as like your life, starting to realize this Guinness fella is a pretty funny guy. Just like you, Brendan. You're a pretty funny guy.
Thanks, Adam. I'm going to assume that comment was all for me, like Jason said. Exactly. Alec Guinness is a funny guy. I knew him as Star Wars before starting any of these movies on the list. Yeah, so
Dr. Star Wars, I called him.
His role, you know, he played that role, Star Wars.
He played the Dr. character. Star Wars, the mentor for Luke Star Wars.
Luke Star Wars. I remember they had to fight Darth Star Wars.
Darth Star Wars? Yeah, that's my favorite part. You remember when Darth Star Wars was Luke Star Wars' father? Who knew? Who could possibly have seen it coming?
I mean, everybody had the last name Star Wars, so I didn't put it together.
That was what they did, yeah.
Okay.
So okay, and every time I see his name, Christopher Barry, because he is a frequent commenter, I feel like there's like a composer named Christopher Barry or something, because I feel like I recognize the name. And if that is you, Christopher Barry, if you are a composer, awesome. You must do some good stuff if I remember your name. Christopher Barry, I consider this stolen valor, and you should change your name immediately.
What do you think they call people like people that are posers, but like they're also composers? Like they're being a poser at being a composer? Like, what would they be called?
I'm not sure, Brendan, but I think you have the start of a really good rap right there.
You think you're a poser, but you're just a composer. You're a poser, composer, poser. I need someone to step in on the lyrics, though.
You can hire someone on Fiverr, I'm sure.
Christopher Barry says, I feel it's underrated compared to The Lady Killers. I find it much funnier. Kind Hearts and Coronets is the superior film, but it's a high bar. Pick this one, Jason, because he's also not a huge fan of Lady Killers. So there you go.
Hey, this guy.
You found a spirit. A fellow spirit. Spirit animal.
Spirit guardian. Mate.
Guardian of the spirit. Okay, what's our last comment?
Our last comment comes from Kenneth McAllenden. McAllenden. I'm going to assume.
McAllenden or McAllenden?
McAllenden. McAllenden. Kenneth McAllenden.
Either way, it's a cool fucking name, Kenneth.
It is a good name, Kenneth. Love it, he says. Certainly in contention for the best of the Ealing comedies up there with Lady Killers and Kind Hearts and Coronets. I would also recommend The Man in the White Suit, which is the best type of satire where both sides of an issue are roasted hilariously. Well, that's going to come up in our list at some point, Brendan.
Yeah.
The Man in the White Suit. We're still waiting.
Could be soon. Could be a long time. It was funny. A little bit of trivia about that movie, as in trivia about our podcast that no one else really knows. We almost did that as our second episode. Because remember we were going to do Dr. Zhivago. Oh no, we were going to do that as our first episode.
Yes. And we decided to re-roll for some reason.
Well, I think we decided to just pick the first movie, or maybe we decided to roll. I don't remember what happened. Either way, it didn't work out. Listen, don't worry about it.
I suspect we may have picked Dr. Zhivago because that was one of the leans I hadn't seen and knew about.
Unseen leans. It's too bad we didn't call this podcast Unseen Leans.
So wait, just to back up in our history for a sec, we did Dr. Zhivago, which is okay, and then we did English Patient, second episode?
No, we did Zulu for our second episode.
Right, okay, because if we did that English Patient for the second episode, I'd have been out. This wouldn't have got past two episodes.
We did have some heavy movies to start for the first
time. Absolutely.
So, I commend you.
I deserve it.
Well, Jason, we come to the end, and what do we do at the end? Well, we find out how this compares to the American Film Institute top 100 list. So so this movie, The Lavender Hill Mob, is number 17 on the BFI top 100. Number 17 on the AFI top 100 is The Graduate.
Ooh, haven't seen it.
What?
But one of those movies that I know it from pop culture because, you know, you can't get away from, what is it? Are you trying to seduce me, Mrs. Robinson, or whatever the fuck he says? That's like the iconic line. I mean, and something about plastics, but that's it. That's all I know. And Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know of Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah. I have no idea what the actual plot of that movie is, just that at some point an older lady seduces a young man, or at least he gets the impression
that she's I feel like that idea that we had of, you know, all those movies that you haven't seen, Jason, that's an entire podcast. I don't know if we could do it all in this show.
We'd basically just have to do Unspooled, and you've already done that on your own. So.
Oh, not the AFI movies, just movies that you haven't seen.
Well, it's. I feel like if I watched the AFI list, I'd be, you know, I'd cover myself. Now, to be fair, Brendan, I have seen a lot of movies in my life. I just haven't necessarily seen them all. I did have a period in my life where I watched a lot of movies. I've seen Evil Dead. I've seen Evil Dead 2. I've seen Army of Darkness.
So. I just want to point out, for the record, Jason has seen the film Wing Commander, has not seen Jaws.
Multiple times.
Has not seen Jaws.
I'm saving it.
Have you seen The Exorcist?
Yes, I saw that in the theater when they did the 20th anniversary re-release.
There you go. All right, well, that's, what am I going to say here? I mean... It's kind of a contemporary class. It's a classic. I love The Lavender Hill Mob. It's a lot of fun, but I mean, it's The Graduate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's The Graduate.
It's an important film. I've been told.
It's a great movie. Mike Nichols, Elaine May, watch it, rent it at your local Jumbo Video. I think that's it. So we're going to jump into it here, Jason. We're going to talk about this week's film, A Room with a View. Yes, that's right. That heavenly, wonderful, some of the best high notes I've ever heard. That music can only mean one thing, Jason. We are talking about A Room with a View. One particular room with one particular view. Are there any trees in the way? Who's to say?
A fine room, a fine view. Thank you and good night.
God save the queen.
That's all you get. That's all you get. The room, the view was lovely. I mean, really, I was ultimately, and sorry to blow the, I don't want to blow my wad so early, but I was really disappointed this entire movie didn't take place in this one room with the view. Like, the whole thing would play out in front of the view. Like, did you ever see The Big Kahuna with Kevin Spacey and Danny DeVito?
Yes, and thank you, and thank you for reminding me of the name of that movie, because for some reason in my head, I kept thinking it was Swimming with Sharks.
That's well, that'd be a good name for it.
Yeah, that's the other Spacey movie.
But yeah, that takes place in one hotel room, but I'd say go one step further, one shot. Like, pretend you're Kevin Smith, one, two shot, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, because no, I'm sure, Jason, that would have been enjoyable to watch.
You put it in my hands, buddy, it'd be the most beautiful thing you ever saw.
We're not watching a fucking 24-hour Andy Warhol film here.
Tell you what, Brendan, I'll make you a bet. If you can give me a $200 million budget, I can make you a one-shot movie that will be the most beautiful thing you ever saw.
Okay, so I'm gonna attack the logic of that right from the get-go. I have $175 million.
Actually, you know what? It's funny you mentioned that. That's exactly the amount over. I added an extra $25 million just to see if you can take it, but $175 million turns out it's exactly what I need.
God damn it. People aren't going to the theaters, Jason. I need this money back.
I need these baskets back.
But yes, we are talking about A Room with a View, 1985. So fairly modern in terms of the movies on this list.
Yeah.
Considering that the newest movie was like 98. Yeah, this is our second, like I said earlier, this is our second Merchant Ivory production, our first being The Remains of the Day with Anthony Hopkins. This movie has a lot of big players in it, a lot of big names.
Yes.
Maybe not at the time, but definitely now. We have leading this movie, we have Helena Bonham Carter, 18 years old at the time.
Yes. A mere 14 years out from Fight Club.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. We had returning to the podcast because we talked about him in The Killing Fields. We have Julian Sands in this movie playing the role of George Emerson. He was one of the reporters in The Killing Fields.
I did not know that.
Not a huge part, but he was in it.
He was in it.
We have Dame Maggie Smith as Charlotte Bartlett, old cousin, spinster cousin Charlotte Bartlett.
Fantastic as always, Maggie Smith.
Oh, she's so good in this movie. We have Denham Elliott, who I feel like we've seen in a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. Pop up time to time, but I think he has a bit more of a substantial role in this one. He plays George's father, Mr. Emerson.
Interestingly, I looked him up on Wikipedia, and it says, you know, Denham Elliott was a British actor, stage person, whatever. Most famous for his roles as, and the very first thing they said was the abortionist in Alfie.
Yeah, he was. He was in that.
That's crazy.
I don't know. I did not... It's crazy that that's listed as his number one.
His voice also sounded really familiar throughout the movie, and I realized about three quarters of the way through, he kind of sounds like Ian Holm. He is that kind of like high-pitched, kind of almost whine. Not in an unpleasant way, but very much like Ian Holm.
You know who I thought he kind of looked like for a lot of the movie? Brian Doyle Murray.
Yeah, kind of. A little bit.
I don't know why. Something about him. He's like the British Brian Doyle Murray.
If he just had more grit in his voice.
Yeah, and if he looked like he was 50 when he was like 30.
Yeah.
So also rounding up this cast, we have history's greatest monster, Daniel Day-Lewis. If you want to know why that.
I was going to say he remains history's greatest monster because I did not realize it was him until like the end of the movie.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Damn you.
Yeah, we'll get it. If you want to know, by the way, guys, why he's history's greatest monster, just go back and listen to any episode we did after talking about a Daniel Day-Lewis movie.
Was that My Left Foot? And
yeah, just listen to the episode after that, because Daniel Day-Lewis has got one on us. I'll just say that.
Gotten a few over on us.
It's true. We also have returning to the podcast another person here. We have Simon Callow, who you might remember from Four Weddings and a Funeral.
As soon as I saw him, I was like, it's that guy.
Yeah, playing Reverend Beebe. Other notable names, just a couple more here. We have making his film debut, I believe, Rupert Graves playing Freddie, Helena Bonham Carter's brother, younger brother. And, of course, Dame Judi Dench showing up for a few brief moments as Eleanor Lavish, a novelist.
A novelist that they make fun of later in the movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's crazy, right? She's a novelist, a lady novelist, Jason.
Who'd have thunk it?
Joking?
Edwardian England, excuse me.
Okay, so this movie takes place in 1907. So I think there's a little bit of context here. You mentioned it's Edwardian England.
Yes.
So do you know, like, maybe I didn't prep you enough for this, but do you know, like, kind of what's going on at the time?
Well, this is so Edwardian England is generally considered a period that ranges from about 1901 when Queen Victoria died through to either, depending on who you ask, 1910 or even I would push it as far as 1914, the beginning of the First World War. It's a particular time in England. It began with the Second Boer War, where England thought that they would, you know, have a pretty easy time with these two little Boer colonies that barely made up the population of London. But no, it ended up being a way bloodier affair than they intended. But for a lot of people, like especially the tastemakers, the pop culture icons of the 20s, it was this period that they look back on with nostalgia, with fondness, because a lot of these people that fought in World War One, that had these life-changing experiences, they grew up in Edwardian times, especially in England. And so through this movie and many other movies set in this period, you see this real like thick lens of nostalgia for these like long summers in the country and idle rich flitting about and, you know, and playing with dolls and, you know, going skinny dipping in the stream or whatever rich assholes did in the early 1900s. But yeah, so this period is a very tinged with nostalgia period. And we can see that in the construction of this movie for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's not quite to the mythical level of something like Chariots of Fire, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, I think the difference too in this movie is that it takes some shots. Yes, like it's absolutely. Not just, oh, what a lovely time 1907 is. No, it has some qualms about that time.
And that's ultimately what kind of makes it interesting, is that it is this layer of nostalgia, but still with these critiques of the old days and how things were done. Well, and because it's clear. I was going to say it's clear because Helena Bonham Carter's character in this movie is very much a forward-thinking, forward-looking young lady who's, you know, for the time, she's probably someone that will end up as a suffragette of some sort. Because I'm pretty sure in the early part, they still, women still did not have the right to vote in the Edwardian era. Maybe that's why some people look back on it fondly. I would tell those people to shut up.
Yeah. Suck it, Boris Johnson.
That's right. It's not like he could exist in that society with that mop of hair. They run him out on a railway.
Sorry.
Weirdo.
wait, hold on a second. We can attack other things. You know, just because you know what? The only thing about Boris Johnson is if he had a better haircut, right. He'd be
if he had a better haircut, he might be a better man.
God,
I say this having no hair, so I believe I'm in a proper position to evaluate other people's haircuts.
You sound like a comedian from like the 50s. I'll tell you, his hair is really bad, so he's a jerk.
This guy's a real heel.
Actually, that could also be a Norm Macdonald bit.
Nah, look at his hair, stupid hair.
But yeah, so you talk about So we're at this period in history. I guess we should maybe just run down like the basics of this plot. Is that we have Helena Bonham Carter is this young lady. She and her spinster cousin Charlotte, this very put upon martyr.
Well, I think she sees that as her kind of lot, because if she is a spinster, as they say, mm-hmm. you know, she got nothing else to look forward to, right? She's never going to get married, and in those days, that was very much like, well, what good are you, right? Well, right. One good was as a chaperone for a young lady who could theoretically get married or get pregnant.
Right. She's basically there to keep an eye on Helena Bonham Carter. And I got to say, so they're in Italy. They're staying at a lovely hotel. They don't like their room because there's no view. I was actually shocked, Jason. I will say this right now. I was shocked that this movie, A Room with a View, started out with two characters saying, our room doesn't have a view. And I was I literally
wrote in my notes, the view is a strong topic off the bat, which is good. They get right into it. They don't fuck around. It's not one of these movies with one of these like esoteric titles that is like, you know, it's a metaphor. No, they literally talk about this fucking room with this goddamn view right off the bat.
I'm almost wondering, because there's something about this movie that it's made to look like one of those like stuffy British movies, period pieces or whatever. But I always felt like there was something just like kind of out of the corner of its eye, just like winking at us. Like, yeah, we know you think you know what you're watching, but we're also kind of doing this at the same time. And I wonder if that's just like the director, like James Ivory, just being like, fuck it, start it with the most on the nose thing possible. And just make them think that that's where we're going with this. And then we could just go into the movie.
But then it ends up, in retrospect, it does end up being an appropriate title, because the entire impetus of the movie, the entire series of complications that happen, ultimately happen because they switch those rooms. And early on, Charlotte's character, or the character of Charlotte, is played by Dame Maggie Smith. Charlotte says she's reticent about switching rooms because she's like, I don't want to be basically in debt to these people that we don't even know, right? So, and obviously she's taking a little darker look at it, but it's not a crazy perspective, given that the rest of the movie, Lucy's life is forever changed because of this little exchange.
Well, okay, and I do want to play a little bit of that scene, but I just want to quickly get through the basics of the story, the rest of the story. So, yeah, they trade rooms with these guys, George Emerson and his father. Lucy and George end up kind of having a little thing, or he kisses her, at least, against her will, which I guess was romantic in 1985.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, they go back. Lucy is set to marry someone else. And it's that whole thing where, like, you know, who does she really love? Does she actually want to get married to this guy, or is she still in love with George? Romance ensues. Mm. We'll get into it. But I do want to play that clip that you mentioned where Charlotte is essentially wondering if she should take them up on the offer to switch rooms or not. Because she, you know, like you said, she says, I don't want to be indebted. I don't want Lucy to have to be indebted to these men who we've just met. And by the way, these men are crazy, Jason. They have wild ideas. They don't adhere to manners or customs. So right off the bat, we're like, oh, who are these Blutos that just walked into this movie? Well, let's listen to Charlotte figuring out what she should do. And we'll also hear Reverend Beebe, Simon Callow, who she's talking to.
This old gentleman and his son offered us their rooms with a view for ours, which have no view.
It was most indelicate. But things that are indelicate can sometimes be beautiful.
Yes.
I am the chaperone to my young cousin Lucy, and it would be a serious thing if I were to put her under an obligation to people of whom we know nothing.
I don't think much harm could have come of accepting.
Fair, Charlotte.
So you think I ought to have accepted? You think I have been narrow-minded?
I never suggested that. If you will allow me, I would be happy to act as intermediary with Mr. Emerson. I do not think he would take advantage of your acceptance, nor expect any gratitude. He has rooms he does not value, and he thinks you would value them.
Charlotte, please.
Well, my own wishes, dearest Lucy, are unimportant in comparison with yours. I am only here through your kindness. If you want me to turn these gentlemen out of their rooms, I will do it. Would you then, Mr. B, kindly tell Mr.
Emerson,
we accept his offer.
That was almost a little coquettish on her part for this spinster. We accept.
Sorry, can you explain? So coquettish, you said?
Yeah, I was just like she was like very come hither, like we accept. Maybe she thinks she's going to meet this Mr. Emerson and maybe she's going to marry him. But that doesn't happen at all during the course of the movie.
Listen, I think that's just your attraction to Dame Maggie Smith coming through.
Well, I mean, is it that obvious?
I mean, you have a full erection right now.
Please teach me something, Professor McGonagall.
Oh, yeah, that is what she's in, isn't it?
Yeah. And, of course, as the what do they call her? The Dowager Countess.
In
Downton Abbey.
Oh, see, I do remember her from Harry Potter, but I've never seen Downton Abbey, so I'm lost there. But she is wonderful in this movie. Maggie Smith is so good in this movie, and right there, I think that's I'll play something later that's I think is like the best example of her like her character and like what she's like and how she's kind of makes. Is really harsh to herself, almost to kind of lure people in. And, you know, I mean, I wonder if it's intentional or not.
Master manipulator.
Yeah, she does kind of seem like one, right? She has this, like, martyrdom about her. But she also seems like she's genuine, too. Like, I think she loves Lucy. Oh, yeah. I truly do. But we do start
as
this
we all
movie
do,
out.
As Desi did.
Except that, according to him, she's got some splaining to do.
Yes. She obviously she got a lot of explaining to do by the end of it.
So I think she really loves her. And I think the movie does its job to position her right away as not like a typical, you know, you'd expect her to be a villain or cruel or whatever. And this scene also does something where it's making fun of it, right? It's making fun of the characters a little bit because it's like, look at what the ridiculous lengths they're going to for this simple request of like, hey, we'll just switch rooms with you. And she's like, oh, well, can you tell them that we accept this offer? And the music swells. And I think this could come off a different way. I think this could come off as this movie is like, you know, it's like a pompous moment in the movie, but I think it's winking at you. I think it's self-aware.
If you want to make this totally pompous, all you got to do is switch everything. No changes to the dialogue. Just put it all in American accents.
It's true.
But with the British accent and knowledge of the time, this all seems like, you know, this is par for the course. This is how they talk back then. You know, overly flowery, too many words. You know, everybody had lots of time back then, so they had time to speak at length.
Right, exactly. Just like us.
Unlike me, a master of perfect editing. All the time
in your house and
every
other
day.
Places in your day-to-day life, you know exactly when to stop your sentences that you're saying out loud to other people.
Preach it, brother.
So, I mean, should we just talk about the if you want to get into the put on my film glasses here. Okay. We got to get into the title. I mean, the title is a giant metaphor, right? A Room with a View. I mean, they literally start off the movie with Lucy not having a view. She yes. can't see the outside world.
No.
Right? She her blinders are on.
By the yeah. end, baby, she's got a view of her own.
And it's mostly George's face, but it's also yes. they do have a room with a view. What I do like too is, so I mean, yeah, we get this whole idea where she's very closed off because they've got her leading this very straightforward life. Everything is decided for her, essentially.
Typical upper class British girl type of life back then, where you didn't really have any agency at all.
Yeah. Which I think makes a scene in this movie even more jarring, I mean, in a good way, is when she finally does decide to go out there and kind of explore a little bit. She sees a man get stabbed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a brutal
Talk about being dropped right into it.
Yeah. I mean, she's in the town square, and she sees two men scuffling, and one of them gets stabbed. And we don't know if he dies or not, but, like, that's not important. We see her seeing extreme violence, like, right there.
I'm going to say he did die because instead of being hauled away by men in white coats, he was held away by men in black masks.
Or maybe he's being born unto another soul.
That's certainly possible. The transference is initiated.
Yes.
That's all I got. That's all I got. Sorry, folks. It can't all work. And we don't edit. So, I mean, we do
edit anything at all. Just leave it raw, including the music that we perform live and the clips that we act out.
You do a very good Maggie Smith, Brendan.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm just going to say it. Your Helena Bonham Carter could be better.
Well, I'm more of Fight Club era Helena Bonham Carter.
That's true. That is your area of expertise.
Wait for it. Here we go. I've been fucked like that since grade school.
But yeah, so we get, again, the room with the view, the metaphor, she's going outside, she sees the stabbing. It's a very, like, distinct comparison they're making right away. Like, this is the real world. This is the shit that's going on in the real world, and she's just, like, immediately exposed to it. Mm. And then right after, George, Julian Sands, who, by the way, doesn't have, like, a whole lot of dialogue. I thought that was interesting. That he's
He doesn't want to like look a, pretty.
Yeah, sullen, pretty man. But he does make it very well known very quickly that he has feelings for this woman, for Helena Bonham Carter, and she doesn't really know how to deal with it. It's very intense.
is that what the question mark was about? Was that just the implication of fuck me?
Okay, yeah, we got to talk about that too. So they go in, they switch rooms, and he's got a giant or he's not a giant; it's a normal size portrait, but on the back of it, he's drawn a question mark. And then he comes in and quickly flips it around. And then also earlier in the movie, when they're all eating dinner, he makes a question mark with his food and shows his plate to her. So I'm not sure what that is either.
My first thought was that he was the Riddler.
And this is an origin story?
And this was an origin story. But
so the Riddler is like 108 years old?
Yes, absolutely. But he only does it twice. I thought that might have been something that would continue to like come back up throughout the course of the movie. But visually, it did not. Certainly, questions were asked throughout the movie. So, but there wasn't a physical manifestation on a wall or a window of a question mark.
I'll actually just throw it out to people listening right now. If anyone has seen this movie and kind of has a better grasp of that whole thing with the question mark, please let us know. Because I'm not entirely sure.
Was there a cut subplot involving this that this is the remnant of? That they just couldn't get rid of these scenes, but they got rid of the rest of it.
See, Batman Forever was originally filmed in 1985, and this was going to be a crossover.
This entire movie was a subplot of Batman Forever that was cut from Batman Forever, but then assembled into its own movie.
And then sent back in time to 1985.
Yeah, well, obviously. Hollywood has that technology, but they don't want to share it.
Yeah, they bastards. I could use it for good.
You know, they're actually filming Casablanca next year. It's fucked.
I hope they don't fuck it up. Shot for shot, they better nail it.
That's right, they better.
and so we also get a sense of like the Emersons. George and his father, like we said, are kooky and crazy.
I was gonna say at one point he indicates he's like George has been raised free of superstition. Basically, in my mind, implying that they're not religious, like they're atheists or agnostics or something, which would be a weird standout thing, certainly in Edwardian England.
Yeah, for sure. I actually do just want to play a little clip here of Mr. Emerson kind of interrupting a tour. They have like this tour going through like the art museum. I believe it's like an art museum, right? And
I think it's like a church, a basilica with art in it that is historical in nature.
And the guy is like pointing out various exhibits, and Mr. Emerson just no worries at all, just chatting it up with Lucy, just to get an example. I think this gives you a real clear example of his character.
Oh, Mr. Eager, good morning. You see me leading a little private tour of my own.
Here he is on his deathbed. Surrounded
Mr. Eager is our English chaplain.
Observe
here
how
in
Giotto
Florence.
In these frescoes, now unhappily ruined by restoration, is untroubled by the snares of anatomy and perspective.
That fat man there. Majestic, he must weigh as much as I do. He's floating up into the sky like an air balloon.
Remember the facts about this church of Santa Croce, how it was built by faith in the full fervor of medievalism.
By faith, indeed. That simply means the workers weren't paid properly.
Pardon me. The chapel is somewhat small for two parties. We will incommode you no longer.
Mr. Ego, no, there's plenty of room for all of us. You don't have to... Oh, dear.
Yeah, so we get a real sense he's kind of anti-establishment a little bit.
Yeah, and the fact that he made a comment about the workers' wages. I like the guy. Mm-hmm. He's got a good head on his shoulders, and he doesn't seem to take much guff from priests. And he must have enough swing, because you'd think if he was just some random nobody, the priest would have just told him to get the fuck out. Not in those words, certainly, but...
he does kind of at the end.
Well, you know, he does the passive-aggressive British thing of being like, oh, I'm so sorry. This room apparently is not big enough for two of us, so we'll just move on. Good day.
At the same time, too, we see George doing this weird thing where he's just walking through the church, and I think like a reverend approaches him or something, and George immediately drops to the ground and just pretends like he's praying or something. And I wasn't sure if that was that supposed to be like a mocking thing? Like, was that...
It may have been a mocking thing, or it may simply have been him. He didn't want to talk to a priest, so he figured if he just got down and started to pray, the priest would leave him alone.
Yeah, and I mean, we get Mr. Emerson saying right away, like, Lucy, listen, you don't need to fall in love with George, but please bring him out of his funk, because I don't know what the fuck is wrong with this kid.
And exactly. It's like, I'm not going to pay for a psychologist. You think I'm going to send him to Freud in Berlin? Fuck that. No, I'm going to get this random 18-year-old girl to go about and fix him for me.
Yeah.
Because that's what they do. They fix men.
Oh, no. Yeah, so we get that. And on the flip side, oh, my God, Jason, my absolute favorite part of this entire movie is Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, no, as I said, I did not realize until later, given that he's such a monster, that he was... But and it's interesting, too, because I would say that this is not one of Daniel Day-Lewis's more, like... not subtle is not the word I'm looking for, but, like, this is very much kind of a caricature. Like I don't think there's a whole lot of depth to this character, and yet he's still fantastic, and this character is compelling to me.
I would argue there is more depth than you... than is like immediately apparent, though, because I mean, I think later on, especially when we get to his like character's exit from the film, where we have that like breakup scene with him and Lucy, I think that is like one of the best, some of the best acting I've ever seen.
It is good. And it does reinforce that he is in fact a human being. But I would nominate his character. Certainly when we're done, we're going to have an award for like overall upper class twit of the year. And this character is absolutely in the running.
Oh my God. It's an amazing performance. And like Daniel Day-Lewis, I wasn't sure, like I knew he was in this. I didn't know how big of a role he had, but thankfully it was a fairly good role, fairly big role. But actually a little thing about this is that he was one of the ones funny enough, because, you know, he's an Oscar winner now. Yeah. One of the ones where they asked him, they're like, oh, you know, you should campaign for getting a nomination for this one, because, you know, people are talking and people are liking what you're doing. And Daniel Day-Lewis was like, I don't feel like it. Could not give two shits.
He does not strike me as a man who is like out there like promoting himself for awards. I think he'd rather be making a barrel or a shoe or something.
Exactly. He'd rather do one movie and then take 3 years off. And that's kind of what he's done like throughout his almost his entire career.
And that's why he's a monster, Brendan, because he's living the goddamn dream.
He really is. He's like, well, money's running low again. I guess I'll do Phantom Thread.
I'll just knock out another Oscar-worthy performance and then go back to life.
I'll just do a movie with Paul Thomas Anderson, I guess. Oh, I got to do another one with him.
See, they need to get him into like Star Wars.
Right.
Like he needs to have his Jeremy Irons in Dungeons and Dragons moment. Like we need to have a really good actor in a really bad movie. And I guess Jeremy Irons had both Lolita and Dungeons and Dragons. But
we talked about that. Lolita remake was perfect. Nothing was wrong with it.
Perfect representation of the book in all forms.
Not creepy at all either.
Check out, folks, by the way, little plug for something I like. Check out Lolita Podcast by Jamie Loftus. It's a great, great listen if you're interested in the history of that book and its portrayal in society. So check it out. Free plug, Jamie. I don't know you, but there it is.
All right, there we go. But Daniel Day-Lewis, he's playing we've seen this kind of role before. So essentially Lucy ends up, you know, George, well, I was gonna say she ends up kissing George, but George ends up kissing her while she's in Italy. He's very forceful. It's a little uncomfortable, especially knowing the real ages of the actors.
But she doesn't try to run away. Wait, okay, so Helena Bonham Carter's 18. How old is he?
He's like 26, 27.
It was fine in the 80s. That was classic 80s relationship age division.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as bad as Teen Witch, where she was 15 and he was like 25.
Or we go further back to Lolita, which some people seem to think is a love story. And in the book, she's 12 years old.
it's troubling.
Very.
But yeah, so she, you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, he kisses her and she doesn't exactly, you know, shoo him away, but that's also like almost
that's also not Bond. And I don't want people to think like, oh yeah, well, she just clearly let it happen, you know, it's on her. Like, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just cinematically she doesn't seem to hate it.
Right, but it's also it's almost like the James Bond school of like, hey, you know what? Pussy Galore wasn't into it at first, but man, she eventually knew it was great.
You just work on them, and eventually they'll break down.
Yeah, that's essentially the message of that movie.
That's how James Bond works, man. That's how it works.
Thankfully, Daniel Craig not so much, but definitely back in the day.
James Bond, you could consider him the millstone of relationships. He just grind you down.
A terrifying notion. But yeah, so she has that moment. Eventually they leave Italy and go back home, and we kind of, I don't know how much time passes. I'm assuming a little bit of time passes, but then we see that she's engaged to Cecil, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, which is the best name for him, by the way. Cecil Vice.
Yeah, well, yeah, oh yeah, Vice. That's a great last name for that character. Also, but can you think of like a heroic Cecil from cinema history?
Why am I thinking of a character named Cecil the Lion? Is that something?
I feel like that might be, but he sounds like a coward.
Ask your girlfriend there, your digital girlfriend.
My digital girlfriend? You mean Google? Yeah. Hey Google, are there any good characters named Cecil?
Well, I don't think that's going to work.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
She didn't understand. Don't worry about it.
Hold on. I got this. Who is Cecil the Lion?
Cecil was a lion who lived primarily in the Huayne National Park in Matabeleland North.
Oh, see the lion that got murdered? Was he the guy that got shot? The dentist that from Minnesota that shot him?
Oh, that's who it is.
Yes. Okay, so that's the one good Cecil. And that Cecil's a martyr.
Yeah. Much like Charlotte in this movie. Okay, so there you go. One good Cecil in real life. But no, I don't think there's any... I can't think of any good, like, movie Cecils. At the very least, I can't think of any that, even if they are, like, not a bad guy, are still, like, a twit.
Absolutely. If you want to go evil with the Cecil, you go one step further. You name them Cyril.
Oh, there's no
like
good Cyril.
Cyril Sneer from the Raccoons. Yeah.
You know what I think of? I think of Cecil B. Demented.
Yeah. I could see the video cover of that in my head when I said the word Cecil.
Underrated John Waters movie. I'll say it here and I'll say it now. Watch it, folks. You will not be disappointed.
And I have to assume Cecil B. DeMille was probably some form of sex crim.
Oh, people back in the 30s and 40s in Hollywood? Nah. I'm assuming nothing bad happened back then. So yeah, so what I was going to say is Daniel Day-Lewis's character is a standout for me, and I do want to play some of his character just talking, because I love him in this movie.
So disgusting the way an engagement is regarded as public property. All those old women smirking.
One has to go through it, I suppose. They won't notice us so very much next time.
But my point is that their whole attitude is wrong. An engagement, horrid word in the first place, is a private matter and should be regarded as such.
Oh.
There's your philosophizing parson.
Don't you like Mr. Beebe either?
I never said so. I consider him far above the average.
Oh,
He's the worst, but he's also like just doing such a good job. Like, I love how he's like, oh, you don't like Mr. B? He's like, oh, he's far above the average.
Yeah, that he's this elitist. So this guy, he's rich, clearly.
Yeah.
And at one point, somebody asked him what his profession is, and he's like, oh, I don't have a profession. I feel that if as long as I do no harm, I should do what I want.
Yes, I love it. He's like, I feel like that is the best representation of decadence.
Yeah,
and I'm
exactly.
Like, you are history's greatest monster, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Absolutely. DDL, man. Man, you got this down. But like, yeah. So, and the thing is that the reason I say that it isn't the deepest character, because I feel like I know this type of character. Like, I feel like I knew people in university that kind of had this outlook, if not as extreme, like this really like elitist kind of like looking down at everybody else and making judgments and like, oh, well, this person isn't as bad as everybody else. The rest of the plebeians and the mudbloods on the ground.
Mudbloods. I do love how, so his whole thing is reading, right? Because almost every scene he's reading from a book. He's dictating out loud because I think in his head he's like, everybody wants to hear me read.
This is the guy that if he existed in like the last 30 years, he would be like, oh no, of course I don't own a television. I read books.
Yeah. And if you would like to hear me read them for 14 hours, you can come to my house and possibly be my wife.
Yes, I'm always reading aloud. So that's your thing. Stop on by.
I mean, that's the thing, right? We know like it's a marriage. It's not a loving marriage that's going to happen.
No.
But he's also not like he's a prick, but he's not like a monster. Again,
no,
it's another character that like you expect to see that kind of thing. You expect to see a character that's like a real piece of shit, and he's not, but he's also like not great.
2020 Dark Brain Jason expected that something real bad was going to happen after she broke up with him, like that he was going to like attack her or try to take advantage of her or something like that. And then it didn't happen because I assume that sort of thing did happen back then, but it would be considered very inelegant, whether that mattered or not.
Very inelegant to attack.
Echo the old ladies from the beginning of the movie. Indelicate.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. And that quote you mentioned earlier, he actually says, I choose to engage in leisure as an example of my decadence.
Yeah. And that's great. That's wonderful. You got that kind of money. You can just be idle rich.
And what's cool is
the worst is, again, this reminds me of these people I may have gone to school with. Like, they think he thinks he knows something about the world because he's read a bunch of fucking books, but he doesn't know shit.
Well, that's the thing. I think we talked about a character like that before, where they're just like, they're a phony. Oh, yeah, we talked about that with the Lady Killers remake.
Yes.
Right? Like, Tom Hanks in that movie, or even Alec Guinness in the original movie, more so.
Definitely. Now, he's not quite, I never got the sense that he's quite as condescending as Cecil is, but it definitely in that ballpark.
Yeah, no, not necessarily just that, but the whole thing where they're kind of a phony. Like, they're reading this thing, and you know what? God knows, maybe they're not even reading what's on there. Maybe the person is illiterate. We don't know.
Exactly, yeah.
But I like how they tie it in, because we didn't really talk about this character a lot, but she's only in the first, like, 30 minutes. But Dame Judi Dench,
yes,
plays a novelist named Eleanor Lavish. By the way, and this is my favorite moment in the entire movie, where Daniel Day-Lewis is reading from her book.
Yes.
We find out, because Lucy asks who wrote it, and she's like, oh, Eleanor Lavish. Like, she was on that vacation with me in Italy. And when she asks him who wrote the book, he looks at it and says, Eleanor Lavish. Like, he can't just fucking pronounce the name.
No. He's doing a Jimmy Pardo bit of intentionally mispronouncing it.
Oh, it's so good. I'm just like, yes, he would fucking pronounce it like that, you fucking you fucking twit. But yeah, he says that, and then through that whole device of, like, Judi Dench, you know, being in Italy, being with everyone else, she finds out that Judi Dench has kind of written the sort of affair into her book.
Yes.
Yeah, because she's like, oh, there's a ghastly section here about a room with a view. And she's like, oh, do read that to me. And so, yeah, he reads it.
And yeah, basically recounts with most detail what happened in the field where George kissed her. And here's my question, Brendan, though. Like, they seem really put off about this, but, like, who's going to know? Like, who's going to figure out that it was her? The only person that literally knows is Eleanor and Charlotte. And Lucy. Those are the only three people in the world that know. And maybe George, if he deemed to read the book. But that's it.
And I mean, we do find out that Charlotte is quite a gossip, though.
That's true. She is, yes.
She has told more people than Lucy thought initially, which was zero.
Well, don't you know, if you're a spinster, that's your one outlet in life is gossip.
Yeah. Actually,
I believe today, Brendan, that is described as spilling the tea, if I'm correct.
Oh, would you like to film the meme right now?
Sure. Oh no, I spilled some tea.
Oh, I thought you were just gonna go the...
Oh, I see. I got you. Well, wait, I'll do a Baby Yoda style.
Okay. There you go. I hope you enjoyed that.
You all can't see this, but Brendan can.
I saw it, and I can confirm that it happened.
Yes.
And a white man has never lied.
Never. Most honest race.
400
years running, baby.
Oh my god, I want out.
Now, to be fair, we're all on the committee, but I still think we're right. Right?
I mean, that's how it works, right? If you decide the rules, you can't break them.
White people certainly aren't subject to conflict of interest rules.
Never. Never. Oh boy. So, going to less depressing things of this movie. I wanted to go back to Charlotte just for a second, because we talked about her. I know I played that scene earlier of her, like, you know, having issues accepting the offer from the Emersons. But I actually want to play one more clip of her to really drive home her martyrdom, because this is, like, just before they leave Italy. She's worried that, like, Lucy's mother will find out about George kissing her, because she sees it, right? She sees it just as it happens. And
yeah.
And she's worried because Lucy tells her mother everything. And this scene is just her, like, you know, making sure that Lucy doesn't say anything in her own way.
Comes. I shall face him.
Oh, no, my dear, you will do no such thing. Oh, my poor dear girl, you are so young. And you've always lived among such nice people. You cannot realize what men can be. This afternoon, for example, if I had not arrived, what would have happened?
I can't think.
Answer me, Lucia. What would have happened if I had not appeared?
You did appear.
Oh, I have vexed you at every turn. It's true. I am too old for you. And too dull. It will be a push to catch the morning train, but we must try. Oh, I have failed in my duty to your mother. She will never forgive me when you tell her. Come away from the window. She will certainly blame me when she hears of it. Certainly. And deservedly.
Why need mother hear of it?
Well, you tell her everything, don't you?
I suppose I do, generally.
There's such a beautiful confidence between you. One would hate to break it. And as I've said before, I am to blame.
I wouldn't want Mother to think so.
She will think so, if you tell her.
I shall never speak of it, either to Mother or to anyone.
We'll both be as silent as the grave.
I mean, that's a technique. That's a very conscious technique right there.
Technique, but also, you know, saving. I think she probably does have some legit concern that that would be a problem for the mother, you know, in that era. And she doesn't want her own ass to get fried in that situation. So
she should join Michael Caine's self-preservation society.
That's right. I'd like to hear her sing that song. But also, she, you know, again, and her being a single woman, an older single woman, is
single white female.
You know, her options are relatively limited for what she can do in her life. And I suppose she doesn't want to lose this gig being chaperone because it gets her out of the house.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what? I realized, too. I know we were we're kind of jumping all over the place, but I know when we were talking about the book earlier, when Cecil was reading out of the book and you were saying, like, I don't know why she's so mad because.
Yeah.
But I think what it is. Is it because, okay, we kind of set up Judi Dench, like the novelist, as like a pretty good observer of human nature.
Mm.
And I think her writing about this passionate, interest between these two characters that Lucy realizes that she's clearly talking about her and George. I think it's almost like, well, she can see it, but Lucy's got to be like in denial about it, right? Yeah. So I think she's like, it's like her battle, right? She's like, oh, I don't want to admit that because I'm supposed to marry this doofus. Like, I can't just be like... Yeah, of course I'm in love with George. And she's saying, well, if someone else can see it, clearly something exists there.
And if this other person can see it, maybe the people around me can too.
That's true. Yeah. So that probably makes her mad. I mean, she acts like she's mad because it's in the book, but I think that might be where her real anger lies.
Yeah.
Also, Jason, I'm just going to say this right now. There is stiff competition now for women in love for that wrestling scene.
I had the exact same thought.
Yeah, there is a scene in this movie you might argue is more homoerotic because we have three characters.
Sure. But I mean, they only wrestle a little bit.
And I'll tell you this, watching it in fast motion while under the influence is pretty funny.
It's like a Benny Hill skit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have like George Freddie, who is like Lucy's brother, who we didn't really talk about a whole lot, and Reverend Beebe, and they all just decide to go take a shower. This is kind of like how a porn starts, right? It kind of set up like a pornography.
Well, they're going for a bathe in the river, and, you know, back in Edwardian times, it was not, you know, unheard of for groups of boys who were going to go swimming to strip off and go naked. That's what you did.
What I was shocked at is all the peen we saw.
Yes, it was a lot of peen in this movie. It was. I wonder if you'd have cut that, would they have had a different rating?
So I looked this up because I was like, okay, if you have this, it has to be rated R in the U.S. But apparently, there was just no rating in the States.
Oh,
I don't think it had enough of a release. I mean, it did clearly have a release because we'll get to the awards section later. But I don't think it was enough for them to like really assign a rating, because in the UK it was PG because they're like, whatever, it's dicks, who cares? Yeah,
it's just guys running around and it's kind of a comedic scene.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not like it's not meant to be erotic or anything. And they're all, I assure you, they're all totally flaccid the entire time.
You assure us?
I went through it with a fine tuned comb to make sure.
And a fine-tuned comb.
A fine-tuned comb, and there is, I assure you, no fires in anyone's ovens.
they're just like in the water, and then they're chasing each other, like Jason said, like Benny Hill. Yeah. And then the women see them, of course, and they're like, oh no, oh.
But they're also not like comedically scandalized, like in a Marx Brothers movie or something. Like they kind of laugh it off, you know, because it's the brother, right? It's like it's Lucy's brother. It's like, oh look, he's running around naked again.
I think Lucy's mother is a little bit more scandalized than anyone else, but yeah, for the most part, they're not like you said, they're not a Marx brother reaction. One thing that surprised me about this movie, because we talked about a lot of period romance, period drama movies, this had a happy ending.
Yeah.
I mean, just that alone kind of shocked me.
Yeah, with these sorts of movies, given like my track record with Downton Abbey and various other types of period movies, there always seems to be a lot of tragedy. And that's understandable because, you know, life sucked in the old days and people were way more likely to die at any given time. But mm-hmm. not so much in this movie. Everything pretty much works out.
Yeah. I mean, she goes off and marries George. And Jason, by God, they get that room with a view. Yes. I'd like to
come back around.
I'd like to believe that this all happens because of George's speech to her later in the movie, because she basically at one point, by the way, this movie is separated by like these cool title cards I really liked. They're like chapters, but they're also like they're also named, right?
Yeah,
like Lying to George, Lying to Mr. Emerson, whatever.
Weirdly, but anyway, on one hand, weirdly retro because it kind of calls back to silent film a little bit. But also for kind of foresight to hipster film because it also had a very Wes Anderson vibe. So I wonder if Wes Anderson maybe watched this movie and like the use of it, or I mean, or any old movie that used title cards, but like, yeah, I just got a real Wes Anderson vibe from the title cards.
Even the opening credits gave a sort of Wes Anderson vibe, the way they announce each character and like their occupation. And sometimes they're like their relationship to the main character. It was interesting, but yeah, no, I was going to say, I wonder, I think it might be George's speech because Lucy decides basically to finally, meet with George and tell him, you know, that kiss was nothing. It was a mistake. I'm marrying Daniel Day-Lewis, greatest monster, history's greatest monster. And George gives this speech. And I think this is a really well-written speech.
Charlotte, please stay. Mr. Emerson, go out of this house and don't come back into it again as long as I live here.
I can't.
No discussion. Go, please. I don't want to call him Mr. Vyse.
You don't mean you're going to marry that man?
You're being ridiculous.
Oh, I would have held back if your Cecil had been a different person. But he's the sort who can't know anyone intimately, least of all a woman. He doesn't know what a woman is. He wants you for a possession, something to look at, like a painting or an ivory box. Something to own and to display. He doesn't want you to be real and to think and to live. He doesn't love you. But I love you. I want you to have your own thoughts and ideas and feelings, even when I hold you in my arms. Miss Bartlett, you wouldn't stop us this time, not if you understood. It's our last chance. Do you understand how lucky people are when they find what's right for them? It's such a blessing, don't you see?
And the fact that I love Cecil and shall be his wife shortly. I suppose that's a detail of no importance.
This tremendous thing has happened between us. And what it means, let me explain. It means that nothing must hinder us ever again. That's what it means. You have to understand that.
I've no idea what you're talking about.
But everyone has to understand.
And you must leave.
So he's a little aggressive, but I mean, I do think that speech is very good and basically breaks down Cecil in a way.
Now, what if that speech had been like in the rain?
But then Helena Bonham Carter would have looked at him and said, "I'm sorry, is it still raining?"
Exactly.
Is that
That's
the line?
Exactly. Yeah. I think so. I didn't realize it was raining. Or
is it
like
still
that.
Raining? Yeah. I hadn't
is
noticed.
It still raining? Yes, that's it.
Yeah,
no, that is a heartfelt scene. And he makes good points. It finally hit me. I was trying to figure out who Daniel Day-Lewis's character Cecil reminded me of, and I realized it was Hitler. And I know that sounds crazy, but like I read a good chunk of Ian Kershaw's biography about Hitler last year, and talking about Hitler as a young man, and he's would very much get along, I think, with a guy like Cecil, because they have similar attitudes, kind of this weird elitism and thinking they're smarter than everybody else and looking down on people. Like, I think they would have been fast friends, Hitler and Cecil.
Does Hitler kiss as awkward as Cecil?
I would have to assume so. I mean, I think one of Hitler's first relationships was with a cousin of his, so...
I mean, that's another great moment in this movie is when Cecil asks if he can kiss Lucy. And clearly he's never kissed a human being.
No, and Daniel Day-Lewis deserves an Oscar for that kiss because it was so perfectly awkward.
Yeah.
And he feels bad afterwards and she feels bad. It's just a complete mess and it's a perfect scene.
So I want to tell you, Jason, before we get into bits and bobs, I do have some background here about this movie as well. This movie has been kicking in Hollywood since like 1946.
Wow.
So in 1946, 20th Century Fox offered $25,000 for the film rights to A Room with a View. But the author of the book, E.M. Forster, didn't think too kindly of Hollywood and was like, nope. So he said no. And finally, when, you know, Forster passed away in 1970, the board of King's College at Cambridge inherited the rights to his books. And but the chief executor of his will still turned down all the approaches. And then finally, 10 years later, the film rights became available when another person, a film enthusiast, a professor named Bernard Williams, became the executor of the will. And he was, like I said, he was big into film. So he was like, yes, of course, make a movie. I can't wait. I'll be the first in line. Do I get free popcorn? And they invited Ismail Merchant and James Ivory, and the rest was history because they made that fucking movie, Jason.
They did.
Talk about a little bit about the casting too. So this is basically Helena Bonham Carter's breakthrough as an actor, playing the role of Lucy Honeychurch. She was 18 at the time and she just finished a movie called Lady Jane, which came out the year after.
Apparently she
was cast because she fit the author's description in the novel of a young lady with a quantity of dark hair and a very pretty, pale, undeveloped face.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Rupert Everett actually almost played Cecil. But then he auditioned for the role of Cecil and he wanted to play the role of George. But you know, James Ivory was like, I don't think you're quite right for it. So, and very young, I think. So Julian Sands, of course, got the lead. Daniel Day-Lewis came in. He came to the attention of James Ivory due to a play he was in at the time where he played a gay character. Mm-hmm. And he was given the choice. Basically, they asked him, they're like, you're amazing. You're Daniel Day-Lewis. You may be history's greatest monster, but we love you.
Yes.
And they said, they gave him the choice of George Emerson or Cecil. And he said, you know, I think Cecil is a much more challenging role to take this character and make him into a, you know, three-dimensional human being.
And he does with that role what another actor might have turned into a cartoon.
Yeah.
It would have been so very easy to do so. And he didn't. He managed to just, he's ridiculous, but he's not unreal.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to respect that kind of ability for DDL to pull that out.
Exactly. Good old DDL.
Mm-hmm.
Simon Callow, you know, from Four Weddings and a Funeral, was the first choice for the character Harry. Remember there's that character they kind of mentioned a few times, Harry, the guy who like is the reason that the Emersons eventually move closer.
Yeah, he's
like
the landlord. He's the landlord. Yeah. Yeah.
But he was he wanted to play the role of Reverend Beebe, and actually he had basically Simon Callow had created the role of Mozart in the original London stage production of Amadeus.
Amadeus, Amadeus, oh, Amadeus.
Exactly. And then he also made his film debut in Amadeus in like a smaller role, but that's where he started.
Also, here's a question I have. Why do they call him Mr. throughout the whole movie? He's a reverend. Shouldn't they call him?
They call him Reverend Beebe, don't they?
Or vicar? Do they refer to him as a vicar?
I think so. I think, you know what? I wonder, now going back, I wonder if it's only Mr. Emerson who calls him Mr. Beebe.
Oh, maybe. It's as a part, because he, you know, you talk about the working man. Maybe also he's got a thing against the clergy, too. Rightfully so. He'll call him Mr. instead of Reverend. Oh, the Doctor of Divinity means nothing, asshole.
It's another character we didn't really talk much about, but I think Simon Callow is perfectly charming in that part.
Oh, yeah.
And like he doesn't have a whole lot of stuff, but every time he pops up, he's a welcome addition.
But and it's interesting, too, because I get the sense from Four Weddings and a Funeral and that Simon Callow as a person is a very boisterous character of a man. And he is not quite that in this movie. A little bit of that comes through, but he's a much more subdued character than, say, like Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is literally the only other thing I have to compare.
Like I said earlier, when I said Daniel Day-Lewis was not interested in doing the Oscar campaigning, they basically were like, all right, well, Denham, you in? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. So he was very enthusiastic, and he actually got his first Oscar nomination as a result. Daniel Day-Lewis also described...
I was going to say, though, but awards-wise, wasn't it also that he won his third of three BAFTA supporting awards?
Well, we'll find out soon.
All right.
Daniel Day-Lewis did, though, one of my favorite things about this is he described his own character as being, quote, the sort of person you imagine you might be in your worst nightmares.
That's a good description. That is nail on the head, man.
Any like other big overall things you want to talk about before we go into bits and possibly bobs?
It's a beautiful movie. It's from a cinematography perspective, it's colorful, yeah. And it's all the things I've liked about other period pieces that are good, like where you have like this lovely landscapes and buildings, and of course we see a lot of Italy, and Italy is beautiful, and so just a stunning movie overall. Now, I wouldn't say quite as nice as something like Chariots of Fire, but definitely in that realm.
Yeah, the cinematography is a sight to see for sure. Well, Jason, on that note, we are going to take a brief break, and we're going to hear some ads from Age of Radio, and we will be right back with Bits and Bobs.
Age of Radio.
I just got the bits. I just got the bobs. I just got the bits and the bobs. Bits and the bobs. Bits and bobs.
Bits and Bobs by Jason. Why is there so many English people in Italy? That's what I want to know. You ever notice, Brendan? How many English people live in Italy?
Do your type five.
A strong lady cast. Was very happy to see, even for a movie from the 80s. Like, this is some, as we said, some heavy hitters, and it was nice to see. All in one place.
I mean, if you can't have diversity, let's at least have some male and female roles.
That's right. Those old ladies in the beginning of the movie were fantastic choices to play old ladies. They just had the right look.
Don't they also have that line, too, where like they're talking about... Because Lucy breaks off the engagement with Cecil in that scene, that, which, again, I can't stress enough. I think that scene is great, and I think that's Daniel Day-Lewis's best acting in the whole movie. Sure. But don't they also have that scene where they're like, Lucy goes to see them, and then she leaves, and one of them is just like, she didn't look like she was engaged. And the other one's like, the other one was like, well, how would you know, you being the expert on that? They have that little exchange, which I thought was funny. And she's like, she wasn't radiant.
Yes. Cute old ladies for sure.
Yes.
Judy Dench's character sort of looks like Katharine Hepburn. Like, she got the red hair and it's kind of pulled up, and she just got that attitude. Certainly not the mid-Atlantic accent, but the real Katharine Hepburn vibe. I don't know if that was intentional, but that's what I got.
She also looks very young.
She does. Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody's young in this movie.
I mean, Maggie Smith has looked the same for years, but
that's true. But she's just a slightly smoother in this movie. I love the usual English condescension, it seems, with regards to the Italians. Like, every time they're talking about the Italian people, they're all just peasants. Don't worry about it. Like, it's that usual thing of English people being in a different country and thinking that they're better than everybody else. And nowadays, that's usually an American. But at this time, you know, when the sun didn't set on the British Empire, it was definitely the British way of things. And may still be. I'd have to ask a British person.
I also like the repeated bits about Cecil saying how much he hates snobs. And I'm like, pot, kettle, black.
I was listening to a Knowledge Fight today, and they were talking about Alex Jones. And Alex Jones had on that, you know, the QAnon shaman, that guy, the fucking dude with the horns and the hair and everything that was in. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. He was on that show, and at some point, Alex Jones was basically mocking him for being a shaman and telling him that they had, like, ruined the... they had ruined everything that was going to happen because of this storming. Even though Alex Jones was, anyway, it's that kind of, what I'm saying is it's that kind of like ridiculousness of like, oh, you guys are crazy. You're wrong. Oh, really, Alex Jones? They're crazy and they're wrong?
How could he in any world call anyone crazy?
I know. It's ridiculous. But that's what I get from Cecil saying, like, complaining about snobs. I mean, he's, you know, a snobba prima.
Yeah, exactly.
God damn it. That asshole priest, the old guy, when they're in the car, or when they're in the wagons getting, or I guess the carriages going, and he's like getting after the carriage driver for snogging with his girlfriend, who the carriage driver tells him it's his sister.
Yeah, he does. He says it's his sister, and then
it's not his sister.
No.
I don't think that is a thing Italians do. I don't think so. I don't think they snog with their sisters.
No, I'm not going to make that stereotype. But Jason, doesn't he get so mad that he makes them leave her in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah. The guy just, he's like, you got to wait here. You got to walk back. Can't have it. He gets so mad. And isn't it ironic that a priest hates groping?
They weren't there yet. They were on their way.
Yeah. Although I suppose this was an Anglican priest, so maybe it's different. I don't know.
Yeah.
They have a picnic out in the field, and it's very pastoral. And I wanted to mention that, like, I do like that aesthetic, even if I don't like the movies as much. Like, we think of like The Go-Between and Chariots of Fire and which Bronte did we watch? Sense and Sensibility.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like that sort of like era. And then of course Downton Abbey for me personally, but yeah, I love that sort of pastoral look. And that scene is one of those great pastoral vistas as they're just sitting there and having a delicious bite to eat. Mm-hmm. Unshaded though. I mean, I don't know about them, but I would bring an umbrella because it's very open and it could get very warm in that field.
I do like in that scene too, where, George is running around free and yelling and having a good time, and Mr. Emerson is like, you know, paying attention to that, and it's so loud and so like obtrusive, but like the other two gentlemen that are there are just like, butter please, two sugars. They basically sound like a British like George Lucas.
Exactly. They certainly wouldn't want to make a fuss.
Yeah,
two sugar. I'd like a Coke Zero please and two sugars.
Yes, Jar Jar.
Oh yes, oh he's so funny. Yes, it reminds me of the minstrel days.
oh dear. Oh dear,
he's an alien face, you see.
Oh no. Oh, cancel that man.
Let's see what else we got here. Fun bit with two hats. I like the bit with two hats. Do you remember that when Mr. Emerson is leaving? Is it Emerson, is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Emerson's leaving, and George, he's like, aren't you coming with us, George? He's like, no, and he puts his hat on top of Mr. Emerson's hat, so he has two hats on, and then as he's going away, he tries to take his hat off to, like, say goodbye, and then he realized he got another one on, so he takes it off, too.
I missed that whole Chaplin bit.
Oh, it was great. It was a fun bit of comedy. and, of course, when I saw Cecil for the first time, I thought, now she's engaged to some nerd? That's what he was, a nerd. A nerd.
You're like that dude in Revenge of the Nerds.
That's right.
I hate nerds. The one with the Darth Vader helmet, right?
Yeah. I don't think we need to say that.
Terrible. Also, I would never call you.
Credit.
I would never call you
a rapist.
Sorry, it won't happen again.
And when that awkward kiss, I thought that there was going to be a bigger deal. Like, I thought that he was going to get like super mad at her and blame her for making it awkward, because he seems like the type like that it would be all her fault because he couldn't kiss her properly.
Talk about Cecil.
Yeah. I thought that he would make a bigger deal out of that, but he didn't. So I guess he's not complete total piece of shit.
Well, that's what I mean. I think he's too demure and like, you know, a bit of a nerd, like you said, to be that kind of monster.
Yeah. And I think at some point Mom makes it pretty clear that she's not super fond of Cecil either and thinks he's a killjoy and an asshole.
Well, neither is her brother.
Yeah.
Her brother is intentionally playing that really aggressive music and like singing at the top of his lungs, to which Cecil just like leaves the room, and then Lucy has to be like, no, he doesn't hate Freddie. He just hates, what does she say? Is like he hates like things that are loud or something like that, or things that
something
are like
dumb like that. Yeah,
things that
like,
are ugly. He doesn't hate people.
Yes.
Yeah,
he hates things that are ugly, which is just totally her trying to justify his stupid behavior. Yeah. Total abusive kind of situation there.
Right.
Although, of course, back then it was just, you know, it was how things were done. You defended your husband or husband-to-be, I imagine.
I thought that ultimately,
Brendan, I thought this movie should have been a love story about Freddie and George, because they really hit it off. And I think they would have been more interesting.
Yeah. This was 1985. That was not legal yet.
I laughed when he's talking, when Cecil's talking about Miss Evesham's book, right? He describes it as, this book contains an absurd account of a view.
Yeah.
Which immediately triggers her, because she knows what's going on, but that's just such a weirdly generic and strange thing to say, an absurd account of a view.
But it also doesn't seem crazy that he would say that. You know what I mean?
No, like, that's absolutely something that would come out of his mouth.
Yeah.
But it's just, in my head, I'm just like, what? Like, if you were describing the view out of a window, what would make it absurd other than something absurd in the view? Like,
I do like too that while that's going on, there's a tennis game and he gets hit in the throat and just kind of like brushes it off and keeps walking.
Because what's gonna do about it? It's like when they say, "Oh, don't you just wait till I'll have to call Cecil." Like in that scene with George, it's like, "Well, I might have to call Mr. Cecil Feist." What's Cecil gonna fucking do about it? You think Cecil's gonna fight George? I don't think so.
He He also in that scene, like or later on, they try to get him to play tennis, and he's like, "No, I'm one of those people. What do you say? Who's just good for nothing but books?"
Yeah, weird little bit of self-deprecation, but just clearly an excuse because he doesn't want to play tennis or do anything that's asked of him.
But also self-deprecation, but also praising himself a little bit.
Yes,
it's a compliment
self wrapped in an alleged self-deprecation. It's politeness, right? It's you can be polite and sound like you're self-effacing, but then it turns out you're actually just an asshole.
Yeah, it's a DDL special.
Absolutely. DDL, man. I fucking salute you, you monster. That's a ballsy move, that kiss on the stairs while Cecil's walking by. But also, I guess it's just George's confidence that Cecil won't pay attention to anything outside his own face.
Oh, like when George... Well, then we should note that's shortly after they hear the book passage.
Yes.
Because I think that's also George realizing, too. As Cecil would say, Elinor Levisham has seen this passion, then clearly she is hiding these feelings for me. And I'm just going to go ahead and kiss her again.
But really, George gets right to the heart of the issue with the relationship between Lucy and Cecil, which is that George wants her as a George would rather her as a person, whereas Cecil wants her as a possession.
Yeah, well, George would rather have Lucy with her own views, her own thoughts on things. He's more interested in that, whereas Cecil is just like, well, I need a wife.
He's like, yeah, the societal thing. It comes back to that. Like, well, I've got to have a wife, and she'll be my wife, and I'll show her off, and she'll parrot my views and support me and do whatever I tell her to.
Yeah, like the president that just left.
I like that all the last title cards were about her lying to everybody.
Yeah. Lying to George, lying to Mr. Emerson, lying to Cecil.
And, of course, they try to keep the breakup quiet, but there's too many connections with George, it seems. That everybody kind of figures out what's going on.
Lucy wants to go to Athens to hide from it all. She's like, I'm going to go to Greece. And Mr. Emerson is like, why are you going to Greece, dear girl? He's like, George loves you, and I know you love George. And that scene at the end is pretty sweet, too. Mm. I think that is.
In the hotel room, you mean?
Yeah, where she's talking to Mr. Emerson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And he basically tells her, like, come on, I'm no dummy. And by the way, I'm his father, and I only found out a week ago what was going on. But he's like, yeah, come on. You guys love each other.
And then it all finishes by coming around full circle, bookending the movie with that damn view again.
Mm-hmm.
That same room, that same view. But finally, Lucy has found what she needs in life, this man.
And I do like how before they cut to that, they have this other couple, and the girl's like, I can't believe we didn't get a room with a view. And then Helena Bonham Carter's like, we have a view.
And I thought, you assholes, you're not going to offer them the room with the view so that Fuck you.
Fuck no. Do you think George and Mr. Emerson needed the view so they can make out?
I mean, it is Italy.
Oh, dude.
I know they don't grope their sisters, but I don't know what they do with their fathers.
And any more bits and bobs, Jason?
Nope, that's it. Bobs and bits, bobbed.
Okay. All right. Well, that's an odd way to put it, but I like it. Well, let's go into the awards section of the podcast, where we talk about all the awards this podcast has received.
Rooftop Comedy 2008.
Yep. Oh, yeah, on our platform. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
This is the first time in a while where I actually have... This movie struck gold at the award ceremonies. Like, this was not necessarily winning all the Oscars or winning all the BAFTAs, but this was nominated for a lot of them. So we'll start with the Americans first and save the best for last, the British.
Obviously.
Any ideas what this might have been nominated for?
Well,
I'll tell you this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So 8 categories in total. 3 of them they won.
Well, I would assume that right out of the gate, you're going to have a best cinematography, best costume design, and probably a best adapted screenplay.
So costume design, adapted screenplay are 2 of the winners. It's nominated.
Okay.
The winner for cinematography is The Mission.
Okay. Don't know that movie. Would it probably be like best score, maybe?
No, the other win is for best art direction.
Okay.
And then all of the other remaining categories. So best supporting actress, Dame Maggie Smith is nominated. The winner that year is Diane Wiest for Hannah and Her Sisters.
Okay.
Best supporting actor, Denham Elliott gets nominated. And the winner that year is Michael Caine for Hannah and Her Sisters.
Michael Caine. Is Hannah and Her Sisters on our list?
No, I believe it's a Woody Allen film, so probably not. I don't think he's British, and I don't think they want to claim him.
Fair enough.
Best director, it's nominated. So James Ivory gets a best director nomination. Other nominees that year, because I think this is a really interesting year. Roland Jaffe for The Mission. Woody Allen for Hannah and Her Sisters. David Lynch for Blue Velvet. He actually got a nomination for that. But the winner that year, probably deservedly so, was Oliver Stone for Platoon.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it was nominated for Best Picture. The nominees that year were The Mission, Hannah and Her Sisters, Children of a Lesser God, and the winner that year was, again, Platoon. Yeah.
Yeah.
all right. Get ready for this, Jason. At the BAFTAs. These are the ones it is nominated for but does not win. It is nominated for Best Director, which was won by Woody Allen. Best Supporting Actor for Denham Elliott and...
British.
What?
You just told me Woody Allen wasn't British.
Well, he doesn't have to be British to win Best Director.
That's horse shit.
It's nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Denham Elliott and Simon Callow, but it's won by an actor named Ray McNally for The Mission. Best Supporting Actress for Rosemary Leach, who actually plays the mother in the movie. Oh. And I forgot to look up who actually won, so fuck me, I guess, right? Oh. Nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, won that year by Out of Africa.
Okay, yeah.
Best Cinematography, also won by Out of Africa. Best Editing, won by The Mission. Best Original Music, won by The Mission. Best Sound, won by Out of Africa. But the things that it wins are... Best Lead Actress for Dame Maggie Smith. Mm. Best Supporting Actress for Judi Dench.
Wow.
Best Costume Design. Best Production Design. And it wins Best Overall Film.
Interesting that they considered that Maggie Smith was a supporting actress in the American version, or in the American version of the awards, and leading actress in the BAFTA.
Oh, no, it was supporting for both.
Oh, was it? Said lead.
No, they were both nominated for supporting actress for the Yanks and the Cranks. That's what we're going to call them, right?
Yeah.
This movie does have that rare 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Roger Ebert gave the movie 4 out of 4 stars. It says it is an intellectual film, but it's intellectual about emotions and encourages us to think about how we feel instead of simply acting on our feelings. The movie cost $3 million to make, and it made 7 times its budget back, $21 million.
A fair return.
Jason, A Room with a View. What's the view look like for you?
That's fine. It's fine. This doesn't stand out to me amongst the various period pictures that we watched. It's perfectly fine. And I like Helena Bonham Carter in it. You know, lots of good performances. DDL, of course, classic as always. But, like, I don't know. It didn't resonate with me. And, you know, it's fine. It's fine. That's all I've got for you, Brendan. We talked all about it, but it's fine. You can, you know, I was actually quite surprised that it was as commercially successful as it was, because usually these sorts of movies aren't that. And this was the one that broke through. So,
well, this was,
I salute them.
Yeah, this was Merchant Ivory's big movie. Like, this was their breakthrough movie. I mean, Sense and Sensibility was a big hit too when it came out, for sure. And of course, being in awards, I mean, this many awards getting nominated for and stuff, I think that helps boost the box office a little bit as well.
Now, I would say certainly the other Merchant Ivory film we've watched was The Remains of the Day, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And that movie I really like. Like, that is a classic. That is really good. And I don't necessarily put this in the same category. It just, it didn't compel me nearly as much. I don't know if that's the lack of Anthony Hopkins, perhaps, but
I think we know it's the lack of Emma Thompson.
That's a big part of it too. But I mean, if you like period pieces, you can't go wrong with this movie. It's a perfectly acceptable, enjoyable period piece, but you know, it's one among many on the BFI.
I do think my favorite of all these like kind of period pieces is probably still Sense and Sensibility.
Yeah.
Of these kinds of like the, you know, the beautiful like cinematography, sweeping shots and everything. I still think that one stands above. Mm-hmm. I still enjoyed this more than I did The Go-Between.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a solid movie. I really do like Merchant Ivory films, is based on my viewings of two of them.
Yes.
It kind of makes me want to go and watch like A Passage to India and a couple of other movies that they made over the years.
Was that David Lean's last movie?
Yeah, but it was a Merchant Ivory production, I think.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I've never seen that one.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. It's one of the few David Lean movies I haven't seen, thanks to this list.
Exactly.
Would you have ever watched Brief Encounter, Jason? Probably not.
Probably not. And I'm so fucking glad I did.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I will say at this point, we're getting to the point now where like we've done a lot of the same-ish kind of movies. And so it's easier for me now to say stuff like, I don't know if we need this one.
Yeah.
Like, I like it. I think it's good. It's very well made. It's very well acted. Daniel Day-Lewis in this movie is phenomenal. Everyone in this movie is great.
Daniel Day-Lewis, far and beyond this, like, his performance in this movie is enjoyable. And definitely be remembered by me long after we're done this run of movies.
But, like, do we need this and Sense and Sensibility and The Go-Between and Far From the Madding Crowd and, you know, all these other, like, same-ish movies? Like, I don't think we need that many of the same. It's my same argument I make for the kitchen sink dramas. I don't think we need that many.
But I would also make the argument too that both the kitchen sink drama and this type of kind of period piece are very much British formats, or very much, you know, just something that's very important in British cinema.
They are, but
that's
like,
why there's so many.
But again, I go back to this, like, how many horror movies are on this list? Like, two?
Just the two.
I mean, that's
and
crazy.
And maybe Attack the Block deserves to be on this list. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Maybe. Well, Jason, I know we are remote right now, but you're going to have to put your trust in me because it's time for the dice roll.
Well, sometimes you got to have faith, Brendan. You got to have faith.
If I could touch your body.
I know not everybody has got a body like me. I was just doing the Limp Bizkit version.
Oh no, get out. you're a real fanatic.
That's right.
So this is the point of the show, Jason, where we roll the dice to find out what movie on the BFI Top 100 we sorry. I had to laugh because Jason started scratching his belly.
It was itchy.
We're gonna find out what movie we talk about next week on the show by rolling these dice. Because the number that we get on this dice will correspond with the number on the BFI Top 100. And the movie that is that number is the one we are going to talk about.
This is all very simple. And if you can't understand it, then maybe you shouldn't fucking listen to this podcast, you dummy.
Wow. Just alienate everyone, Jason. I don't know if you can see this. I'm making sure the camera can see this here. We've got a green 10s D10 and a red D10.
And since I'm the only person that's seeing that, I can confirm that is the case.
Okay, perfect. And now I'm going to outright lie to you when I roll the dice.
All right.
Do you have the list ready, Jason?
Why, yes, Brendan. Of course I do.
So I'm going to roll the green one first, the 10s D10. and then I'm going to roll the other one, and we're going to find out what movie we're going to talk about. This is exciting.
It's very exciting.
It may take 85 tries at this point.
This may be a while, so buckle
Here
up.
Here we go. Here we go. All right, we're in the 30s, Jason.
30s, all right. Here we go.
All right, let's see here. 38.
Oh, well, there you go, Brendan. Wow. Next week, our movie will be the 1991 Alan Parker film, The Commitments.
Huh.
Yeah, which I've heard of that movie before, but I know very little about it. I think it's about a musical group. I'm not sure.
I believe you are correct there. I have also heard about it, and for some reason have owned it on DVD for many a year and never watched it. So.
Well, now's your opportunity.
I don't know if I still have the DVD, but I'll still watch it.
Well, you find that DVD and then mail it to me.
Okay, and then you'll mail it back and I'll watch it.
That's right.
And you guys, this episode is coming up in 4 weeks because this might take a while. All right, well, cool. We're staying kind of recent-ish in terms of this list. 1991, The Commitments, number 38. We'll talk about that next week.
This would be the 30th anniversary of that movie, actually, this year.
Oh, interesting. Oh, really? Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, no, it almost. I mean, it would be.
1991 to 2021, that's 30 years.
Yeah. Right on the dot, Jason.
Yeah.
There we go. Hopefully that movie came out in like the early part of 2021 and then we could really nail it down.
Yeah.
but yeah, we'll talk about that next week. But until then, you can find us on social media, on Twitter at @BFI_pod. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Screen
and Country.
You can find Jason on Twitter.
That's @JasonDMacLeod, MacLeod. Sometimes I drop some dank memes. Sometimes I just rant about work. But all the time, I'm there for you, baby. I'm there for you, the fans. That's why I live. I live for the fans, yo.
And sometimes he falls in love with men named George.
Well, it's hard not to.
They're curious.
George sees me as a person and not a possession, Brendan. And that resonates. I'm pounding my chest Celine Dion style right now.
I hate to be the one to tell you, but George is just a curious monkey.
Oh, actually.
Yeah. You're actually in love with the man with the yellow hat.
I do like a yellow hat.
Well, we're going to have to figure this out, Jason, off air.
All right.
But until
make
that
some calls.
Time, yeah, we'll make some calls. We'll hold some delegations. But until we talk about The Commitments next week, I just have to say to you... God save the queen.
God save the screen.
And for Screen and Country, I'm Brandon.
And I'm Jason.
I'm in love with you.
I'm a person, not a possession. You can't just love me like I'm a thing.
Damn it.
A room without you and you. And no one to worry us, no one to hurry us through this dream we found. We'll gaze at the sky and try to guess what it's all about. Then we will figure out why the world is round. We'll be as happy and contented as birds upon a tree, high above the mountains and seas.